music here on Your Rancho Book Radio being performed by David Dinger. Great music. Perfect for the show, don't you think? And you can find David's music online at David R. Dinger Music, D-I-N-G-E-R, David R. Dinger Music.com. The song is called Woden's Day, and thanks again to David R. Dinger for allowing me to use his music. Welcome to the podcast. Special guest is Jerry Johnson coming up, someone involved with Doing Good in the World, part of a group of fellow Your Rancho Book readers who are part of freeschools.org. You've heard me talk about freeschools.org in previous podcasts, whose work results in pulling kids out of poverty by simply teaching them to read and write. Jerry will share her story in just a moment, along with some insights on her discovery of the Your Rancho Book and some discussions about religion in general in the world today and her thoughts on the role of the Your Rancho Book teachings in the future. So tell me how you found the Your Rancho Book and what your growing up was like, and how did the way you grew up perhaps prepare you for being interested in the Your Rancho Book?
Okay. I grew up in a Catholic family. My mother was Catholic. My father was not. I attended Catholic schools. My dad had agreed that he would raise the children Catholic, which the Catholics always request. So I grew up going to Catholic school. When I was in second grade, the sister teaching our class told us that only Catholics could go to heaven. And I went home in tears to my mother that my father was not going to be able to go to heaven with us. And my mother had to make a choice.
Wow. How old were you?
I'm sorry, what?
How old was this when this happened?
Second grade, so probably seven or eight, somewhere in there.
Yeah, that's.
So my mom makes the choice for peace in the family and for soothing me. And she diplomatically said, "Oh, honey, your teacher loves the Catholic faith so much she wants everyone to be a Catholic, but God loves every good person and all good people will go to heaven and your daddy will go to heaven." So, saved. My heart was saved at the moment. But I think what I learned from that experience is that there isn't just one truth. There may be versions of truth out there, and I think that stayed latent in me. But years later, and I'm now in around 17, 18, and I'm really pondering God and our relationship and what's going to happen. And one of my friends says, one night a bunch of us are on the beach and we're looking out at the stars, and she says, "Do you think, if there's life out there, do you think Jesus had to go to all those other planets and die also for our sins?"
Whew. That's a tough question.
That just blew my mind. Literally, it opened up all sorts of possibilities, because I'm still thinking in a very Catholic mold, a very, earth-centric mold. And all of a sudden, I had my first thoughts about... I was believing that there was life out there, but the fact that that Jesus would be going to all those worlds also, and that question burned in me. At the age of 19, in my mind, I formally left the Catholic Church to go search for God, and I started studying other religions. It was about a year and a half later when I was introduced to the Your Rancho Book. I was in my late 20s, maybe just 21, and I was introduced to the Your Rancho Book. And so I was fascinated by it. I am a person that loves history and context and origins and how things start. And I found the Your Rancho Book, and I mean, part three, and then Jesus' life. Oh, my goodness. All those questions there. I just loved it. But I also had a reservation about it. Is this really true? How do I know this is true? And at roughly the same time as receiving the Urantia book, I was introduced to the Baha'i world faith. And I started reading some of the Baha'i works, especially from Abdul Baha, the son of Baha'u'llah. And I attended what they call fireside meetings. And I got into understanding one of their precepts about progressive revelation and how a prophet comes, repeats the truth of what people understood in the past, and adds more concepts. As we evolve and can understand more, then this new truth giver, they call it a manifestation of God, comes and reveals more truth. And wham, the puzzle piece fell in, and I went right back to the Urantia book and started reading it in earnest. I mean, I was always reading it earnestly, but seriously. I started reading it seriously and decided, yes, this is the highest truth on the planet. I still love what Baha'u'llah wrote. Absolutely agree with him. And the Urantia offers so much more. So
it's interesting that you had that introduction, but you didn't. But instead of going with the Baha'i faith, you went you went back to the Urantia faith, or pursuing the Urantia book. That's a very interesting, right? Yeah.
And I've always considered my time studying with the Baha'is and studying the Baha'i faith was what really helped solidify my being able to determine that the Urantia book was true.
So I've heard people compare the Baha'i faith to, they've said that they're very complementary to each other. Is that true?
There are a lot of things in there that are complementary, absolutely. You know, especially the concepts of religion and the personal relationship with God, and then how they lay out a society of brotherhood. They don't necessarily use that term, but, you know, they lay out this whole society of brotherhood and our connection to God and to the universe. They don't talk so much about the universe as the Urantia book gets into it. But certainly their concepts on religion and progressive religious development are very complementary.
Mm.
They see Jesus as a manifestation of God, which they equate to being someone that is, they don't use the word divine, but certainly someone that God has empowered with his love and you know, to be a teacher. And they don't really take it to that level of being a divine son. And I think that, for me, was the dividing point, because having been raised Catholic, I believed at that point that Jesus was the eternal son, what we call the eternal son. He was the son of God. The Urantia book expanded that concept, of course. And that, I think, is what was the big difference for me between Baha'i and the Urantia book was Jesus and the position that Jesus plays in our lives, but also who he is in the universe.
So, but by the same token, what is it that differentiates, and this comes up often, the differentiation between the Christian view of Christ and the Urantia view of Christ, and what is your, what, how do you see that difference?
Well, in mainstream Christianity, and specifically I can talk about Catholicism because that's my background, there is the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And Jesus is the Son. And so, of course, in the Urantia book, he is a creator Son, and he is the Son of the Father and the Eternal Son. And, as we learn more about the organization of the universe, the super universes, the grand universe, Havona, and our path to paradise, we can, in the Urantia book, we see Jesus as our creator father, and or Michael,
yeah.
You know, Christ Michael as our creator father. So there is a difference there, and that is sometimes a stumbling block for many Christians, that what, there's more than one son?
Yeah. Yeah, they feel that it takes away from, but they don't realize the real estate we're talking about here, because
Yes, there you go.
I mean, that's really what it is. It's in my father's house are many mansions.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of them too. You know, 70 trillion of them from the last count. That's very interesting, and I like your refreshing take on it because a lot of people are very academic about it. And one of the other contentions, which I think differentiates somebody who likes the Urantia book versus what Christianity offers, is the Urantia book very specifically says that the whole redemption concept is rooted in this incessant need for man to negotiate with the gods for forgiveness and for the remission of sins, past sins, ancestral sins. We're all guilty of something. And even today, I can see certain tenets in the environmental movement, which, you know, people in the West, they feel somewhat guilty, perhaps, that they have so much luxury, they have so much wealth, and so they're going to get punished for it if they're not careful, you know, how they continue to be stewards of our planet. It's still sort of that psychological, we're going to get punished someday because life is so good for us or because God is so good and we're not. And I think that's one of the things that made me like the Urantia book, because up until that point, I was pretty okay with the idea that I was a sinner. But then I started thinking about what that really meant and the relationship that I didn't have with my Creator by assuming that position, because then I felt like I wasn't worthy of God's love. And of course, that's young thinking. And I don't always think that way today, because none of us are innocent, really. We're, you know, we're animal. You know, I admit it. We have some of those traits. But at the end of the day, the like in the movie The Life of Pi, I like the story better with the Urantia book because it's much more detailed. It answers all of my questions. Do you sort of relate to that?
I sure do. It does relate. And I'm going to pick up on what you said about sometimes not feeling worthy, because having been raised Catholic, you're raised with a whole lot of guilt, okay? Mm. That's one of their ways they keep you in check. And I love the line in the Urantia book that says, you know, that kind of confirms, yeah, you're not worthy, you know, but there lives within you one who is.
Yeah.
And he will make you worthy, you know. And so I love that concept that, yes, you know, we don't have to carry that load of guilt around anymore. It's not true to begin with. It's not a reality.
Yeah.
But I do. I find the Urantia book has such a breadth of it for all minds and all interest levels. I will admit readily that once it gets into the, you know, some of the more heavier philosophical areas, it takes me quite a while to work through the verbiage to understand what's going on. And I've had to treat it actually as an academic study and make myself list and charts and to be able to keep different personalities straight here.
Yeah, there used to be a book out a long time ago. I have a copy of it lying around where somebody actually went and made all the charts. You know, it was just a great, I think I'll have to find it. And maybe they still have it in
there's
the library.
Several of them.
Yeah.
I think there's several, but I know Hara Davis did an absolute wonderful book on, you know, sorting out all these different beings and personalities and entities and having lovely charts. But having the stories through part three, and then, of course, the whole life and teachings of Jesus, the restatement of his life.
Yeah.
The way those stories flow are just remarkable to me. And even when it gets into, you know, well, into the religion papers and into the thought adjusters and bringing those concepts down in such a way where we can not just embrace them, but feel them too as you're reading them. It's a remarkable experience when you take this book into your soul, because you're taking God into your soul. You know, it's giving us so much more understanding. And we're told we're a good dispensation or more behind the average, average planet.
Where we should be.
So,
Where, and that has to do with our intellectual understanding. of things of a spiritual nature, because many of us admittedly still worship, we still think of many of our symbols are still really based on thousands of years of luggage, you know, things that we've inherited from all of the previous beliefs. They still hang with us. Even the whole marriage ceremony is really rooted in tens and thousands of years of little cultural idioms that got attached to the tree of human life. So it's interesting. I want to ask you about what you do with freeschools.org, and I want to get into that. Before I do, though, you've lived in a lot of different places as a teacher and a doer, really. I mean, you've lived in Singapore, I think you told me, Bangladesh, a lot of time in India.
No, I didn't live in... Yeah. Yeah, I didn't live in Bangladesh. I lived in Singapore.
Uh-huh.
I lived in India, and our free schools, part of the state of Bihar, where our free schools are, borders Bangladesh, but I didn't live there. And I lived in Saudi Arabia.
That's right.
And I spent a number of summers in England for various reasons, but I was taking professional development courses in the summer times, and I did it in England. And so I lived there about three different summers.
And there aren't too many people you can ask this question and get a what I think would be a well-educated answer. But what are some of the commonalities that you see in people, no matter where they're from or wherever you've been? What are the commonalities that we share despite our differences?
The first thing you can always relate to is family and children. We've all been in families. And when you're, especially in Saudi Arabia, for me, because I got to know a lot of families there. I taught in a Saudi girls' school. I taught English as a second language. And so I got to know the moms and the children. And so that was our commonality, was family and raising children and wanting the best for them and wanting them to have opportunities in life. And certainly in Singapore, education is primary with people there, and that was always a way forward or into a relationship with them, was through children and talking about their growth and, you know, how to help them have a leg up in life to be a good character, a strong character, and a successful person. Success is big in Singapore.
A lot of places, right? That's another common. Everybody wants to be successful. They want to have something.
India also.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. That's also another strong commonality. Mm. And so relating to each other as family is, or to their family, and talking about, you know, the issues of parenting and helping to raise children, universal for around the world.
Mm. And so the Urantia book, you mentioned when we had a talk a few days ago, the way that it's received in certain countries, tell me a little bit about that, because you had mentioned that the way that we read it or the way that we think about it or it works in the United States is a little different from other places where they're learning about the fifth epical revelation.
I can't talk with any great authority here. So understand that my experiences are perhaps limited to certain groups of families, all right?
Yeah.
Or to certain people. In Saudi Arabia, I couldn't talk about it at all. For one thing, to try and share the Urantia book, you can't proselytize in Saudi Arabia. It is against the law. And to try and convert someone could mean death to them, okay? So there is only one religion, and it's Islam. However, that being said, you could always relate and talk about concepts. And I would ask my Saudi friends about something, and I'd say, well, what does the Quran say about this, okay? Or what does the Quran say about that? And that would lead us into conversations where then I could drop various seeds, but I could never really share the book. And I prefer to share a relationship with God first, long before I ever share the Urantia book with someone. So Saudi, there really was no sharing of the book in country.
Yeah.
Singapore, I had various experiences there. There's a growing Christian community, but there's also a very large Buddhist community. And so we would then talk more on concepts. And with the Buddhists, we would talk about meditation and prayer and then worship and what that meant to them and what it might mean to me. With the Christians, they are very gung-ho. Most of them are converts. So they are strong in what they believe. And there we would just talk about our Father, you know, God is our Father, and our brotherhood between us.
Right. The common threads between, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The common threads between us, and then enhance that. I noticed when I would go to Australia, and I was close enough when I lived in Singapore to go there for conferences and then and sightseeing, and that the families there, I've noticed that the Urantia book has been passed down to their children, and there were lots of children at the conferences, and we're talking teenagers, and that were participating. They were reading the book. Now, whether this was, you know, I can think of 5-6 families, so maybe it's just those families I got to see, mm-hmm. but I was very impressed with how the children were involved with the Urantia book. Also, and I know some parents that did family, you know, Urantia studies with their mm-hmm. children. Now, there are those of us in the United States that did that also. And sometimes to the detriment, some of our children didn't want the Urantia book as a result, you know, and others have taken to it. But mm-hmm. I was impressed with how in Australia with what I, you know, with the little snippets I could see that how involved the the Urantia book was in the families and with the second generation of readers. Mm. So
fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. That I liked. I have been, you know, reading online at the foundation website about the number of books that are going around the world. And it seems they're all going, not all, they're strongest in countries that have a Christian tradition, and specifically a Catholic tradition, like down in South America, Portugal, Spain, and Poland. And they're getting a lot of, downloads of the book there. Of course, the book's in their languages. They're in Spanish, in Portuguese, and in Polish. And there's the downloads for these books are quite high in these countries. So, we're told that in the Urantia book that the teachings of Jesus, what do they say, are still slumber,
yeah,
you know? His ideals of the religion he's taught are slumbering in the Christian tradition and are to be awakened. And I think when I look at what's happening and with book sales or the download of books in these countries, you see that, you know, there may be an awakening that's coming about. I'm making lots of assumptions here, I know, but I'm looking for, you know, what threads are happening there?
Yeah.
And these are definitely traditions that have strong Christian, you know, countries that have strong Christian traditions.
Yeah,
we're
I think
told
so.
Jesus' truths are going to come about. And you know, South America is really
booming,
doing some wonderful things down there. Yeah, lots of study groups and lots of young people getting involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Catholicism provides good soil. I mean, my own mm-hmm. growing up, I was introduced to enough of Christian thought where it had a soil. So something like the Urantia book, I'd already kind of had some of those concepts already there, so it wasn't a strange. People that grow up with no religion at all, they're not even. I've rarely met an atheist or a secularist who has had any interest in the Urantia book, any interest whatsoever, because of the very question that you mentioned a few years ago. Your own experience was well, how do I know it's true? And therein lies the problem, because if you can't get past that question, then none of the other stuff matters. And that's a personal choice, by the way, because ultimately it's always going to come down to, do I have faith enough in my own belief system or in my own convictions to follow this where it will lead? And we know that that's not a common trait. It's very specific. You have to want to, it's like you have to knock. The door's not just going to open. You got to knock. You know, and you're not going to knock unless you're interested in seeing what's on the other side. So, but do you have any thoughts on that, on what you think keeps the book from being more widely accepted, perhaps just in the United States, where it never seems to pop? Do you know what I mean? It hasn't popped yet. I never hear anybody refer to it.
I've actually run into a number of people on airplanes or something like that, that have heard of the Urantia book or know about it somehow. So I do think we're fighting materialism. And even though the Urantia book says that the worst of the material age is over,
That's hard to believe.
Really?
What? Are you kidding me? Well, how could you say that before smartphones?
And I'm thinking, is there a difference between materialism and secularism, you know? Because
true.
We're definitely a secular material society. But even with that, there are a lot of people, a lot of Urantia readers that are quietly working in their communities. They're involved in churches or other communities, and they're spreading seeds. And I do believe that one day, this is going to maybe reach a tipping point. I don't know when, and I think more is needed. I think we all need to be out there forming relationships with people and sharing our ideals with them. But it does not, you're right, today it does not look like it's widespread. However, book sales are up, downloads are up.
Right.
The hits on the websites are up. People are searching.
Yeah.
So
I'll tell you what, I agree with you. And I, you know, sometimes I think, one of the advantages of, and I've had discussions with people about this, we have to be careful what we ask for. Because if you have like a Tom Cruise or a John Travolta or somebody who comes out and all of a sudden he's a Urantia book reader and, oh, there's all this kind of excitement. Well, now you've got a bunch of people that are easily swayed by pop culture, and that's not what we're about. You know, we're not, this isn't I still have arguments today with people. Is it a religion? Is it not a religion? Where do you come down on that?
I'm not ready to call it a religion as such, but I might use the phrase that Kurt Sierra uses, and about it's a religion, a personal experience with God. So when I do talk about it, I talk about how it is your personal experience with our Heavenly Father that grows. And in that, it fosters religious living, spiritual living. So
That's a good way to put it.
And when people ask me, what is the Urantia book? I'll say it is a spiritual philosophy book that leads to, that will enhance your religious living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. Paula Thompson called it a how-to.
Even though we are Urantians, we're not really fostering a religion with a church and a set creed.
Which is a good thing. And Paula Thompson, who I think you probably know, said it best. She says a lot of other religions are how-tos. This is more of a how-come.
Like
we got
that.
Here, right? Yeah, a roadmap to the stars. So, So what is your, you are part of an endeavor, which was the main reason I brought you on, where you're doing something that's fantastic. You and a group of people have been doing this for a long time in India, as you mentioned, in Bihar. And it's this idea of teaching young girls how to read, such a simple thing. And yet the
literacy.
Yeah.
Yes.
So tell us about the organization that you've been a part of.
Okay, it's called Free Schools World Literacy, and it has been in India and in Thailand. And I'll very briefly say we worked our way out of a job in Thailand because the schools were so successful, the Thai schools took, the Thai government took over management of them. And to me, that's a huge success story.
Congratulations, yeah.
These schools initially started in India, and they are in mostly in Bihar, but we do have some in the Delhi area also. And it was the charity itself was started by Sue Tennant, who was a Urantia reader. About 2 years ago, she graduated and went on to the Mansion Worlds. She met Sister Crescence in Bihar through Mark Bloomfield, who is a Urantia reader, and Robert Conrad's another reader. So most of the people, all of the people in the beginning stages of Free Schools were students of the Urantia book, and they all saw the value of teaching young children how to read, to become literate. If nothing else, it is the best step out of poverty that's possible for them. We have, our model is very simple. We have village schools, a teacher, if we can, the teacher is from the village, but if not, she's nearby. She's definitely of the same religion as the children in the village. If it's a Hindu religion village or a Muslim village, that's what the teacher is. Sister Crescence is very careful not to confuse Christianity in here, and that she's trying to proselytize. That's also against the law in India, is to proselytize Christianity. So she is very careful with that, and her endeavor truly is to educate children. In the village schools, we have one teacher, anywhere from 30 to 50 children, a big whiteboard, slates, books, pencils, sand, for them.
Yeah.
They sit on their own little rice that they bring with them in their little sack, along with their notebooks that they're given, and prepare to learn. The village schools are girls and boys. We can't ignore boys.
Mm-hmm.
We have to work twice as hard to get girls, and to allow the parents to send their daughters to learn and to school.
Yeah.
The classes take place in the late afternoon, 3 to 5 in the afternoon, maybe, 4 to 6, because all of these children work in the village. They work in the home. They care for the animals. An older daughter might watch the younger children so mom can go work out in the fields. So this is to accommodate their work schedule. And these are household chores. They're not, well, in the town, some of them are probably enforced labor, but in the villages, this is just village life, okay?
Yeah.
Everybody works. Excuse me. I had a cough. So everybody works. And the school, like I said, the school times meet their needs.
Mm-hmm.
And the children come, and younger, 3-year-olds will come with their older sibling because that's the sibling's job, is to take care of the younger one. And I'm looking at this going, yoo-hoo, early childhood, education here. That little sibling's going to expect to go to school one day,
Yeah.
So our schools take place throughout the whole year. It's a very simple format, and we use borrowed space. Sometimes we use a Catholic school that's nearby, a tuition school, and we'll use their grounds in the afternoon. Most of the time, it's somebody in the village has donated a courtyard, or they meet under a common tree. So there's no money paid out for buildings and infrastructure. All of our costs go to the teacher salary, teacher continuing education, and then supplies for the kids.
Sister
Crescent.
Oh, go ahead.
Pardon me?
Continue, please.
No, okay, I was going to say. And then, of course, for Sister Crescent's expenses to get to the villages where she, observes, trains the teachers, works side by side with them while she's training them. And then once a month, they come together for teacher meetings, and they share their experiences, and they, you know, she'll then teach them different strategies of how to keep the children's attention or other ways of instructing.
Yeah.
And I am most happy about when I lived in India, when I was working at the American Embassy School in New Delhi, I was able to bring the teachers from Bihar, a core group of eight, to Delhi and have them view different schools in Delhi. And these would be village schools or neighborhood schools, Indian schools, not the international schools, but something comparable to what they were doing, but better than theirs. Mm. And so they were able to, you know, have a model of how they could grow. And then I arranged for them to have a literacy course with a group called Pratham Books, which is something, you know, they create books for slum and village children to teach, you know, teaching them literacy. And we use their books, which are all Indian, written by Indians. The pictures are all appropriate. You know, the books are appropriate to their culture is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So they then had a full day literacy session there. And this continues now. Sister Crescents is able to bring in about once a year. We bring in somebody and continue their education in Bihar. So that to me is very exciting because a teacher always has to remain a learner.
Mm-hmm.
Attached to our schools, we have five or six. The numbers always vary depending on the teacher availability. But we have five or six tailoring schools where the girls can come to learn how to sew, crochet, knit. And this gives them homemaking skills, but it also gives them some income stream, you know, and many of our older girls have gone on to have little tailoring businesses in their home, and they're able to earn money. Several of them have used that money to go to college. Others are married, and they use the money to help augment the family income. And that is the idea, is to give them, you know, a way to augment their life. The tailoring schools begin, the girls begin at age 12 and on up. So we'll take even, you know, young moms that are maybe haven't been in our literacy schools, but they want to learn how to sew, and we'll take them in and they can develop these kinds of skills.
We're talking to Jerry
Sister
Johnson.
Crescent.
Let me just reintroduce you for those who joined us. Jerry Johnson from freeschools.org, also your Urantia book reader. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions, and in your knowledge of anthropology and, you know, social development, evolution of society, where are these people in your mind, if you were to compare them to a stage of human evolution, where are these people that you're dealing with in this environment? What would you say? Still in the Stone Age? Still sort of in the beginnings of the... I mean, certainly it must occur to you the disparity between how these people live versus the rest of the world. It's just such a wide gulf.
It is a huge gulf. And I would say my first trip to India for the schools, not my first trip to India, but to go see the schools, that would have been 2009 or 2010 in that era. So that's what, just 12 years ago.
Yeah.
There is a huge disparity between then and now because of the cell phone. And many of the villages we went to had no electricity. The floors are all packed dirt, okay? They lived by one water pump or a water hole, dirty water, so they're always got some kind of microbes in their stomachs, you know, and very basic food. I would have said, and of course it was my first impression the first couple of times I went, but it appeared so primitive. Rarely are the parents literate. So these are children that are, you know, learning something that their parents don't know. they might know numbers, so they know which bus to catch into town. You know, they might know, they might recognize some letters that are on an advertisement, so they know what product it is. But they're really illiterate as far as being able to manage any, you know, read a contract or write their own name on something and know what they're signing.
Mm-hmm. It must have occurred to you at some point, gee, now I know what it was like during Adam and Eve's time. You know, because you're starting from scratch.
John Lang was with us. I don't know, Dr. John Lang, he's a Urantia book reader, was with us. He's part of the board also. And he, my second time to India, he was part of the group. We often go, you know, 3-4 of us at a time. And I commented to him one day, and he would have these medical clinics. The sisters that we stayed with, they were half nursing and then half medical. And they would want him to go do these medical clinics. Really, the sisters are pretty much diagnosing and dispensing the money, but they needed his medical degree to be able to give the patients the right medicine.
Yeah.
And he knew, he would just say, you know, he's part of the dog and pony show, but he was truly interested in everybody that sat in front of him. He'd check, you know, he'd give them some kind of a physical examination and talk to the sisters about them, and they would translate for him. And after one of these days of a medical clinic where they literally brought sick people in wheelbarrows to him,
yeah,
and the lines were maybe 30, 40 people sick, okay?
Yeah.
Or long. I commented to him, I said, this must have been what Adam and Eve found. And he shook his head and he said, no, I think it was more like what the prince's staff.
Wow. Even further back in time. Wow, that's amazing.
Even further back. And these were very distant villages we were in,
yeah,
at this point.
Are some these untouchables that you
2 were?
2 hours
away.
You know, the term.
There would be some of the untouchables there, the aboriginals, yes.
Yeah.
They would be there, and the untouchables, that's true. There was also villages of people that were caught in a double whammy. They were Muslim. And when Bangladesh opened their doors and said, we'll take in the Muslims, they left everything in India, gave up their lands, and moved to the nearest Muslim country, which was then forming Bangladesh.
Yeah.
Within 20 years, Bangladesh couldn't handle any more people, and they sent them all back. Anyone born in India has to go back to India. So now these people are twice dispossessed. They left everything, went to Bangladesh. Now they have to leave everything there, and they're sent back to India. They're very fearful. They're very suspicious. That's the word. And we had schools in their villages, and they would actually glare at us sometimes, and I'm sure it was like, what are you going to do to our children?
Yeah.
And they definitely believe in the evil eye.
Right.
Okay.
Bad luck. Good
and
luck.
So
yeah,
I would very, on my few times in the villages with them, I would always begin, when we were invited to say hello to the children, I'd always begin with the Arabic greetings. And Arabic greetings are universal around the world. Even though they didn't speak Arabic, everybody knows Salamu alaikum, okay, peace be upon you. And then the other greeting is, wouldn't you know it? It just went right out of my head. but you're offering them God's peace upon them, okay?
Yeah,
right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, okay? So in the name of God, the merciful, the mercy giver is what you're saying. And so I would always start with that, and I could see the parents who are standing on the sidelines, you know, kind of looking like, oh, okay, this might be all right.
Yeah, yeah.
And
first impressions go a long way, don't they?
They do.
Yeah.
They do. But, yeah, over the years, cell phones have come, and everybody has them. They're very affordable in India. Everybody has a cell phone. Television has come into some of the villages as electricity,
gets,
you know, further out into the hinterland. And they're now looking at these, you know, the men and the women are looking at these what we would call soap operas, Indian soap operas.
The universal language.
The universal language. But they're seeing women have rights to drive or to talk back to their husband or to do get a job. And this is making great inroads into the village thinking these days. So, and because of this earlier successes with our girls receiving an education, parents are more willing to let their daughters be educated.
Yeah.
I also want to mention we have another program. I've only talked about our village schools, but I'd like to mention about our bridge course. And this is a residential program where we can take up to, I think now we can hold 28, but we usually get about 20, 22 girls each year. We can keep them, educate them for 2 years. Of course, they go home for vacations, and most definitely their parents have to agree to this.
Yeah.
But we are able to bring in girls that have been very successful in our village schools. They test into the bridge course program, and we bring them up to a Indian eighth grade standard, which we would call eighth grade in the U.S., but to the eighth standard, and they take formal tests to receive that ranking. So this is a legacy of the British Empire, where they do have exams and even later on civil service exams. And these exam scores are really a leg up in the world. It's what determines if you can go on to higher education and what kind of jobs you can qualify for.
So let's give out the website, which is freeschools.org, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And that's how you can find out more if you want to. We have a fun drive going for every person who listens to this podcast or any podcast from your Rancher Radio podcast. You automatically contribute a few pennies, a few shekels to the overall cause. And then at the end of the year, whatever that amount is, I'm writing a check and it's going to be given to you. So,
thank you so much.
And you can do.
I do want to put in a plug then that we do have a place online where you can donate.
Mm-hmm.
$30 will send a child to a village school for a year.
That's unbelievable.
So,
I wish I could get my kids to be that conscientious about money.
And it's in the neighborhood of $300 sends a girl to our residential program for a year. I think it's $325.
Which is
pennies.
But
that will send a girl to the residential program for a year.
Okay. Well, anybody listening, now's a good time to give. Everybody's talking about root causes of poverty. Well, the first step is literacy. And you guys are proof of that. And what makes me particularly proud is that you're actually doing what people are supposed to do. And if we did more of this, we would have less of the other stuff, I think. So God bless you and what you're doing. And Jerry Johnson has been my guest. Yes, go ahead.
I just want to thank you so much for giving me the time to talk about free schools and what's going on in the world. And we are to do service in our homes and in our own community. And if we can, then someplace far away.
Jerry, are there other people involved? If you would like to give a shout out or mention some of the other people, who would they be?
Absolutely. I'd like to do this. Of course, Sue Tennant started the charity and Derek Tennant continues in her place today. Saskia Rivori has been there from the beginning with Sue, as has been John Tennant. Robert Conrad's in Australia and Afe Hodemaker in Canada are very involved in free schools. And myself. So we're kind of the core of the free schools advisory board. And
well, thank you.
Bruce Wenger in Arizona. There we go.
Bruce Wenger in Arizona. Got it.
Yes.
All right. To you and to them, thank you very much. God bless and thank you again for joining me.